The Exchange podcast is sponsored by Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucettesurvey.com. That's doucetesurvey.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Welcome to the last in our series of Rudman Center Conversations with the Candidates, coming to you from the Rudman Center at UNH School of Law. Our candidate tonight is New Hampshire's 2nd District Congresswoman, Anne McLean Custer. She's seeking a second term. I'd like to thank our sponsors of this series, Eastern Bank and Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center. Throughout the hour, in addition to my own questions, we'll be sharing questions we receive from our listeners before this event, and we'll take questions from our audience here at the Rudman Center. And Congresswoman Custer, welcome and thanks for making time out for us. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Laura. I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, let's talk about President Obama, and you've said he's not on the ballot this time around, but the president himself said, yes, his policies are kind of on the ballot this time around. His approval ratings, as you know, are very low in the Granite State. Republicans have talked a lot about that. You said, Congresswoman, back in February that you were one of the president's strongest supporters in the state, but during this campaign, you and other Democrats have been distancing yourself from him. So what's changed between back in February when you said that and now?
Well, I think, Laura, the bottom line is I represent the people of the 2nd District in New Hampshire. And when the people agree with the president, then I'm right there. And when they disagree and when I disagree, he'll be the first to know about it. And we've had a few issues of late, most notably since the rollout of the Affordable Care Act went so badly in New Hampshire. We've had a big issue about that. As you know, the first year having just the one health care insurer, and it was difficult for people here. And so I took a series of votes that were contrary to the president's position. My goal is to fix it. There are other issues that we've talked about on the campaign quite a bit. One is the chain CPI, which is sort of an inside the beltway, cutting the benefits on Social Security. I disagree with the president and my opponent on that one. And so, you know, there are issues where we agree and then there are issues where we disagree. And as I say, he hears about it.
Well, most of the analysis of your voting records show that you do vote 90%-ish with the president.
Well, you know what's interesting when they talk about voting records, because you have to take into account the fact that I also vote with Speaker John Boehner on bipartisan bills that have gone through the process, that have gotten everybody on board, and they get signed into law by the president. So those are sort of can be misconstrued because, sure, we've had some terrific bills come out of this Congress. Most notably, I'm proud to have worked on the Farm Bill, a bipartisan bill. And secondly, the Veterans Reform Bill. But overall, it's been the most dysfunctional, least productive Congress, I believe, ever. And, you know, the Tea Party and Speaker Boehner are really, in my view, to blame for that.
Well, I definitely want to ask you about all the items that you mentioned, Congresswoman, the Affordable Care Act, chain CPI, the Farm Bill for sure, because you're on the Agriculture Committee, Veterans Reform, because you sit on the Veterans Committee. One more political question, though, if I could. How are we as voters supposed to view this? Democrats cozying up to the president when he's popular and kind of running away when he's not?
Well, I think they view it the same way voters view it. You know, he was tremendously popular when he was here in New Hampshire, both in 2008 and then again in 2012. But in any administration, as time goes on, mistakes happen, things happen. And look, I think people are disappointed right now. It's a very challenging time in the world. People are worried about Ebola. They're worried about ISIS. And they don't see a lot of leadership and direction coming out of the White House. So my views are really the same in many ways as my constituents' views. And I think they track pretty well right along.
Well, you mentioned the Farm Bill as an example of a bipartisan bill, and you're right, there haven't been a lot of bipartisan bills in the House. I have two cards, actually, from our listeners, Congresswoman Custer. I'd like to share both of them with you because they're a little bit different.
Sure.
So here's a card from our audience here at the Rudman Center. Can you tell us more about your position on the Agriculture Committee and how you're serving on that committee helps New Hampshire. So let's address that real quick, and then I have another one also on the Farm Bill.
Sure. So what's exciting for me about the Agriculture Committee is that it has such a broad jurisdiction. I would have thought that it was narrow and that it wouldn't meet as many needs of New Hampshire constituents, but have in mind all of the nutrition programming, so all of the nutrition assistance for low-income families, as well as school lunches and that. That was a big fight and a big issue, and I fought very, very hard, and in the end, we prevailed. It also entails all of the timber and national forests. So in terms of the North Country and huge parts of my district, it's a critical issue for jobs, bioenergy, timber jobs, wood product industry. And then one that I was not aware of is something called rural development that comes through the USDA. And it's been really thrilling to me to be a part of opening clinics in Bristol and a veterans center coming soon in Plymouth. So this is a rural district, and it turns out there are lots of things that are done through the USDA that benefit the people here in the 2nd District.
Well, and when you think of New Hampshire, you don't think of, you know, Iowa or Kansas, where, you know, farming is king. But you're right, there are a lot of small farmers and a lot of other rural development opportunities in the Farm Bill that would affect New Hampshire. I did want to ask you about the Farm Bill that came out this year. And as you said, it was a hard-fought battle. New Hampshire farmers have long felt like these farm bills favor the big guys over the little guys, and it's pretty much little guys here. So how did this farm bill help out small Granite State farmers?
Well, thank you for asking, Laura. First off, I'm the first person in 70 years from New Hampshire to be on the Agriculture Committee. So it gives you a sense of how far our agriculture policy has swung to the big agribusiness in the Midwest. I'm excited about a lot of the wins that we got because of that, particularly for organics, small family farms, farmers markets, and also land preservation, wildlife conservation. This is another area that I should have mentioned that impacts lots and lots of people across New Hampshire and the natural beauty of New Hampshire. So I was quite excited about, we had 100 different amendments when we marked up the bill, and the ones that I was pushing prevailed, and I'm proud of that.
Well, as you said, policy has swung toward big agribusiness, and a big critique of this Farm Bill, Congresswoman, is that it didn't change the much maligned practice of giving out huge subsidies to the giant farms while the smaller guys get kind of spare change. This is despite longstanding rhetoric about how this is and how we should spend our taxpayer monies. What do you make of that criticism, fair or not, that this doesn't change the subsidy system?
Sure. Actually, it did. We eliminated the direct payments, and this was major change in farming policy in the United States, and actually with little fanfare in the end, but so the direct payments are no longer happening. And I would like to go further. I want to continue to represent the not just small farms, but I think an entire movement in food of eating local, buying local, having those dollars spent within our community, and frankly, having food be much, much healthier. There's so much evidence out there that the big agribusiness is not a healthy way for Americans to eat, and leading to some of our public health issues like obesity, diabetes, and et cetera.
Well, according to the New Republic, the bill did, you're right, it changed the old direct payment program, but it extended crop subsidy insurance, which the New Republic anyway said looks different, but actually hands over the same amount of taxpayer money. So new title, same
it's
problem.
It's a new concept, though. Crop insurance is different than direct subsidy. What was happening under the direct subsidy bill that I thought, I was shocked, those are the stories that you hear that farmers are actually being paid not to grow crops. That just seems outrageous.
Right, which drives people
waste.
Crazy.
Yeah, and waste of taxpayer dollars, and frankly, shouldn't happen. So I was pleased to be a part of getting rid of that. The new program, which is going to be carefully scrutinized, has more to do with insurance so that when you have, and this would lead into the climate change discussion, but when you have major shifts in weather events or some types of issues that could impact the crop in that way, typically it is weather related, that you don't wipe out the farmer completely.
Well, and a lot of people don't realize, and I myself didn't realize until I looked at this, that a lot of the Farm Bill does is made up by the food stamp program. And I want to ask you a question about that,
sure.
Congresswoman Custer. Here's an email from Nathan. I'm a progressive Democrat and have been very disappointed in your record since being elected in 2012. One of the things he mentions, the back-to-work amendment and the Senate budget. He says you also voted for the farm bill despite cut to SNAP benefits. Again, those are food stamps. Nathan says, given that record, are you worried about losing votes on the left from disillusioned progressives like me? A lot of liberal Democrats were very upset about the cut that food stamps took
in
the farm bill.
Well, let me explain it. I appreciate the opportunity. So what happened was we had a bipartisan bill coming out of committee where we kept the cuts to a minimum. And some of the issue around the cut, by the way, is a sort of one of those sleight of hands inside the beltway type move where people were it was a mechanism where if you had a dollar in energy subsidy, you qualified for food stamps. Ironically, it's the red states that were taking advantage of that to the tune of a lot of taxpayer dollars.
This is the heat and eat program.
Yes. So I had said from the get-go that every tax dollar should be spent wisely or not spent at all, and I said that repeatedly. But in any event, what happened was we brought our bipartisan bill out of committee, and I expected it to pass on the floor and go to the Senate. It wasn't what happened. The Tea Party went after it. Another 100 amendments, and some of them just more and more mean-spirited. They wanted literally drug testing in order to receive food stamps. And it just was outrageous. So there was a whole group of us that refused to vote for it on the floor, and it didn't pass as a result. So the Republicans went back into their caucus, and the Tea Party really had a heyday. And they negotiated. They couldn't, there was no number that the Tea Party was willing to accept in terms of food stamp cuts, SNAP cuts. $20 billion wasn't enough. $40 billion wasn't enough. $60 billion wasn't enough. They brought a bill to the House floor with no nutrition title. It was completely outrageous. Luckily, and this is a plug for a vote for Jean Shaheen on Tuesday, the Senate had enough Democratic votes to prevail, and they returned a bill to us that was much more reasonable with regard to the cuts. And the House and the Senate came together in a committee of conference. There were cuts, but they were in the single-digit millions.
$8 billion, I think.
Yes, rather than 20, 40, 60. So I beg to differ with the person on the email. I went to bat for the SNAP program, and I'm very proud of that.
Well, Nathan, thank you for the email. And thanks to the other person who submitted a question from our audience here at the Rudman Center. And we've got some more questions from our audience, Congresswoman, that will go to in just a moment, but I did want to turn to an issue that came up in your debate last night with Marilinda Garcia. WMUR polled its listeners and said, you know, what are some of the very top issues that you want to hear from these candidates about? And people told WMUR, want to hear about guns. In the debate, you were asked if you would support any changes to federal gun laws. You spoke at length about how gun owners feel strongly about firearms for hunting and for safety. But you also spoke about the fears that some parents have of sending their kids to school or to the mall. You didn't offer, though, Congresswoman, any specifics on what changes would you like to see. Can you give us some specifics now? How do you think federal gun laws should be changed, if at all?
Sure. So I do need to start, though, with the basic premise that I support the Second Amendment. I think it's important to this district and both for hunting and personal safety. But what I believe needs to happen is really a broad conversation. And we started that. We had that opportunity after Newtown. We spent a lot of time in Congress. I'm involved with a group that led by Mike Thompson that is leading a discussion on what could be done.
Who's Mike Thompson?
Is a member of Congress who is involved in this issue. He's actually a big NRA and very involved from
Republican?
That side. Democrat.
Democrat, okay.
And, you know, now I have colleagues from all over the country whose districts have been involved in these incidents in Colorado, in Arizona. My colleague Ron Barber was shot when Gabby Giffords was shot. So, and certainly my colleague Elizabeth Esty in Newtown. People coming together to talk about what is it that is going on in our society. You know, my opponent last night talked about enforcing laws that are on the books. Well, if that was sufficient, we wouldn't be having these incidents. So we've got to look at there are some specifics around domestic violence and stalking and whether people should be permitted to have guns. There's a discussion to be had around mental health and around violent behaviors and around let's give it more scrutiny, frankly, so that we can be certain that the people who are licensed for firearms are the people that are going to use them for hunting, that are going to use them for personal safety, but are not going to be a threat to our society.
Well, one way that some say that could be done, including Carol Shea Porter in the 1st District, is an expansion of federal background checks to include gun shows and online sales, basically requiring these sellers to follow the same procedures that licensed gun shops follow already. In fact, Carol Shea Porter, with us about a week ago, described it as kind of like TSA screening, you know, at the airport, yep. That only 60% of passengers get screened and 40% bypass the line with no scrutiny. What do you think? Would you support such an expansion of background checks? This was a big deal after Newtown. Everybody was talking
about
it.
Sure, and that was one of the examples that I have signed on to bills that support that change. And
so you would support expanded background checks.
Yeah, and one of the things, what I was just talking about, the food stamps, and I was so shocked about the drug tests for getting food stamps. There aren't drug tests for using a weapon, you know? And so I think we need to have at least that type of scrutiny.
So just to be clear, you do support expanded background checks.
Yes.
Another item that's been out there, Congresswoman, is the idea of limiting so-called high-capacity magazines, guns that have high-capacity magazines. What do you think about that?
It ends up to be very controversial in terms of how you define that. I had used an expression about military style because the people I speak to here in New Hampshire, they don't have any interest in hunting with a military-style weapon, you know, and it's not necessary for protecting yourself in the home. So that's all part of the discussion.
Why do you suppose, Congresswoman, you know, after Newtown, Vice President Biden, President Obama said, we are going to change this. Democrats said, this is the watershed moment, and now here we are, and nothing's changed.
Well, again, let's come back to campaign finance reform and the role that the NRA plays in the Congress. I mean, I think it's pretty obvious if you connect the dots why it doesn't happen.
Here's a question, an email actually that came in earlier from Laura, not me, I promise. I have my own opportunity to ask questions. This email from Laura says, ordinary Americans are painfully aware that our representatives are accountable not to us, this gets to what you just said about campaign finance, but to wealthy donors to their campaigns. In light of this, I wonder if you will vote for a publicly financed small donor system for financing elections. Laura, thank you for the email.
Absolutely, Laura. In fact, I am one of the original co-sponsors with my colleague John Sarbanes from Maryland. It's an excellent bill. I recommend everybody check it out. And that's precisely it encourages low-dollar contributions. And that's what I've done in my campaigns is spend my time and energy on low-dollar contributions. I think we're up to over 12,000 donors, average contribution under $75. That's what we've done is reach out to people, $7, $11, $15. I have one of my donors here with us tonight who brings in $10 bill in cash, and it's very meaningful to me. And so the people that I represent here in the 2nd District are all constituents, left, right, and center, Republican, Democrat, Independent. I am not beholden to anyone. And I think that's actually one of the biggest distinctions between my record and my opponent. The Koch brothers have now spent millions of dollars attacking me personally. She's gone out to California to their campaign school, comes back with her Tea Party playbook, and that is the way she's going to vote. And I'm going to vote for the people here in New Hampshire.
In fairness, there have been ads on your behalf, too, by outside groups, but we will get to that in a moment. I have a couple more questions, actually, on campaign finance.
Sure.
Given the huge amounts of money that we've seen in these campaigns, more conversation with Congresswoman Ann McClain Custer in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange on NHPR. Welcome to the last in our series of Rudman Center Conversations with the Candidates at UNH School of Law. Our candidate is Democratic U.S. Congresswoman Anne McLean Custer. She's running for re-election in New Hampshire's 2nd Congressional District. And Congresswoman Custer, just a couple more questions about this whole money in politics. Throughout this Conversations with the Candidates series here at the Rudman Center, every night we get a question from at least one person asking about the money that's involved, especially this year. A lot of people have been talking about how Congress is in permanent campaign mode. The minute you're elected, you're expected to spend, 4 hours a day fundraising, more time perhaps than you spend in committees and on the House floor. You've been noted as a prolific fundraiser. What do you think about this permanent campaign mode and its ability for members of Congress to study the issues, to meet with regular folks?
Well, it calls for a long day, but it's really why I support the campaign finance reform. I do think the system is broken. And what I've tried to do until we get to that place is, as I explained, have grassroots support for my campaign. I think you know that in 2010 and 12, I had over 200 house parties flying back and forth to Washington every week. I obviously haven't had the opportunity to do that. But by running a grassroots campaign and by funding my campaign in that way, I do stay in touch with people all across the district. We have events all the time. And it actually keeps me in very close touch with what people are thinking about and talking about. And so it's important, and it's all part of – I just try to do the job that I'm sent to do. Obviously, the hearings, the preparation, the work – a huge part of the job is meeting with people, and I don't know that people particularly understand that, but we have the most highly educated district in the country and the most highly engaged. I get over 1,000 letters, emails, phone calls per week.
Well, as the host of this and talk show, that does not surprise
me at
all.
Yes, that's what I was thinking on the way in.
I know how engaged people are and how smart they are.
Exactly. I was thinking of your audience on the way in because I'm sure we have a lot of overlap, you and I. And it's a wonderful experience. And I'm coming home every week having events. We've done this Congress at Your Company where I'm out meeting, viewing these companies, talking with employees in a open town hall style, lots of Q&A, and learning about what I can do for our economy. My number one priority, jobs in the economy. How can I be a part of growing our economy here in New Hampshire? And then as well, we have a program that we call Congress in Your Community, where I visit nonprofits. Every hospital in the district, every college in the district, the community colleges, the local clinics and such. And that's how I stay connected to people. So I feel blessed to have the support that way, because then I can turn my back on these special interests that control Congress.
Well, and since you're talking about, Congress in your community and meetings mm-hmm. with business and so forth, another critique of you and other Democrats during this campaign cycle has been that you guys are kind of hiding from the public, not holding unscripted events, not holding prepared meetings with a select group of constituents. How do you respond to that criticism? I've heard it a lot.
Well, you know what's funny? This cycle, my opponent, it can't talk about her positions on the issues because the voters don't agree with her positions on the issues. She has this extreme Tea Party agenda that is not in keeping with the views of the 2nd District. So she's latched on to sort of these other critiques. And the irony to the whole thing, ultimately it boils down, she had five sort of what I would call scripted events, but mainly just for a publicity stunt. I'm doing these events all the time. I am out in the community.
Open? Is
Absolutely.
It invitation only? They're...
No. Open events. I meet people where they are. One of the things that we found is that people's lives are busy. So if I have a seniors forum, I go out to Peterborough, I get the word out. We have a whole group of people open. What's different is she's looking for a publicity stunt to get it in the newspaper for the campaign. I'm just doing my job meeting with people and having a conversation, and they don't get covered in the press, and I understand that. I also meet individually with constituents all the time, and of course we have our whole program where we are doing casework for people, tracking down Social Security checks.
That's
tracking
the work
down
of a member of Congress, constituent
service,
and so forth.
We had job fairs. The job fairs were fabulous, and that was a really exciting thing, and those are completely open. We have over 300 people in Nashua, Concord, Claremont, and then we did a special one for veterans down in Nashua, which was terrific.
I want to ask you one more question about this whole feeling that people have, as our emailer Laura said earlier, that Congress is not for them anymore. It's for the big money. It's for the lobbyists. As a former lobbyist yourself at the New Hampshire State House for pharmaceutical companies and other businesses, how do you feel now, Congresswoman, about D.C. lobbyists and how much power they have? Also, given how people feel about lobbyists, are you downplaying your role as a lobbyist in this campaign?
No, I mean, I've been an advocate. I've been an attorney, an adoption attorney. And what I ran for Congress because Congress is broken. You know, I'm the first to tell you that. And I want to make a difference. And one of the advantages I have is I understand how this money and influence plays out. And I'll give you an example, Laura. And this all relates back to the campaign finance reform and having this grassroots support. One example from the left, one from the right. One was a union, one was a pharmaceutical company. They showed up in my office thinking that they could influence my vote. And I said, but I don't agree with you on the position that you're trying to propose. And they said, yes, but we contributed to you. And I said, thank you. Like, period, the end. I am going to vote with the vote with the constituents of the 2nd Congressional District. And frankly, I feel great to have that kind of independence, to know how those people try to influence the process. I listen to everyone. And again, a lot of the time is meetings, all the different organizations that you can imagine, and yes, including public radio, that come to Washington, D.C., meet in my office, meet with me, meet with my staff, talk about the legislation, talk about their point of view. And we don't ever ask, are you Republican or Democrat? It's not relevant. What's relevant is what's best for the 2nd District in New Hampshire.
Well, let's get to the Affordable Care Act, because that has come up a couple times, so I'd love to dive into that with you. The employer mandate requiring firms between 50 and 100 full-time workers has been put off twice, and the mandate for those with 100 or more has been softened. But ultimately, companies that don't comply with this mandate will face fines of $2,000 to $3,000 per employee. That's a lot of money. What if a business can't afford it?
Well, let me just say from the start, this is one of the examples of issues where I differed from the president and, frankly, from my own leadership. I have voted to fix the Affordable Care Act. And again, listening to my constituents, people do not want to repeal it. My opponent wants outright repeal and double down in the Concord Monitor about not repeal and replace.
And we talked to her on Monday, so we'll just focus on you.
What I want to do is make sure that we have broad access to affordable health care. That's the goal. Now, you have to keep in mind that when people don't have health insurance and show up for free at the hospital, there's cost shifting, and you and I all pay for it. And so the goal is to try to have as many people covered as possible to bring down the rates. And that's the direction we're headed, but that's why I voted to delay the mandate, because I don't think we're there yet. We're not ready. New Hampshire certainly was not ready with just the one provider. But the good news coming out this week publicly is that we're going to have five different health insurers, over 60 different plans. And what's great about that is that we will have options for everyone. If you care about access and you want every single hospital in your plan, there will be three different companies that will offer that. If you care about a lower cost, they may have less access but lower cost, then you can choose that. And this is my Republican roots. Let's get back to competition, bring down the cost, and increase access and quality.
Here's a question from someone in our audience. Jillian says, how will you ensure that cancer patients have access to quality, affordable health insurance? It's a great question, Jillian, because cancer can be a very expensive disease.
Well, I'm so glad, Jillian, that you asked. And she may have heard this or maybe not. I actually lobbied the administration, Department of Health and Human Services, to change their interpretation so that cancer medication preventative treatment would be included and covered under the preventative treatment in the Affordable Care Act. Historically, what's happened is you can get coverage for the initial surgery, maybe the initial radiation treatment, but that going forward, preventative treatment would not be covered. And I'm very pleased to report that Secretary Sebelius made a decision in our favor where all cancer treatment, including that preventative treatment, will be covered under the Affordable Care Act.
Thanks for that question, Jillian. Here's another one from Mark. This also has to do with the Affordable Care Act. He says, when Jimmy Kimmel asked people whether they preferred Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act, they said they were against Obamacare and for the Affordable Care Act.
I've heard people say that.
Mark says, words matter. Why do some Democrats reinforce the conservative frame? Mark, thank you for the question.
It's a great question. And I don't hesitate to call it Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act or increasing access to affordable insurance for all Americans. I think the point is the same. This has been a challenging goal, and it continues to be, and I'll continue to be a person that is voting to fix it, not replace it. Look, nobody wants to go back to the place where you couldn't get insurance if you had a pre-existing condition or you hit your lifetime caps if you had a very ill child. So whatever we call it, let's try to increase access to affordable care, and it'll improve the quality of life for everyone here in the Granite State.
Well, and I've heard you and other Democrats say nobody wants to go back to the quote-unquote bad old days, but the polling, Congresswoman Custer, shows the public still unconvinced. Nationally, 51% of Americans disapprove of the ACA, 43% approve, and in New Hampshire, the numbers look even worse. This is from the UNH Survey Center, which is sort of our gold standard for polling here. 52% here in the Granite State oppose the Affordable Care Act, 35% approve. So if the ACA is so great, as you and Shaheen and Shea Porter have been saying, how come the public doesn't agree?
Well, we're not there yet. And I agree with the public in the skepticism. I was extremely frustrated. The rollout was a fiasco. That's what they remember. If you ask them about it, that's what they remember. Having only one provider here in New Hampshire was a serious problem for people. People lost access to their physician in their hospital. And so we're not there yet. And I don't expect those numbers to change until we do get to the place where it's working well. One thing, though, I would have to point out in the polling, you've got to ask the question. There are people in those polls who don't like the Affordable Care Act because they'd prefer the public option.
That was the public option that was debated early on.
Yes, where that we didn't choose. We chose the public insurance option. But there are people in the poll that don't. They say no to Obamacare because they want the system more similar to Canada.
Well, I want to thank both of those people for those
questions.
And we will move on, but it's an important issue. Here's a Facebook comment from EJ that came in earlier. He says, where does the Congresswoman stand on the effort to expand passenger rail from Boston to Concord along New Hampshire's Capital Corridor? And I think there's a meeting coming up on this, by the way, at the state level next week or the week after. So this is talked about a lot.
Absolutely. Thank you, EJ. Well, it's a number one priority in the 2nd District, particularly in Nashua, but hopefully making its way to Concord. This is a big, big issue. And again, I differ from my opponent. I'm going to be strong on rail. I'm going to lean into it. I am very interested in the report that's coming out on what is the most viable plan and what is the most viable option. But I can predict that we're going to need all hands on deck, as the governor would say. It's going to take local funding, state funding, and federal funding.
Well, that's my question. Estimated costs, $250 million, $350 million.
I don't
think
it's that high. $200 is what I've heard.
Where's that going to come from? That's huge.
And again, it's going to take lots of different sources. But that's the way we do things here in New Hampshire, with everyone pulling together. You know, look at the cost of Interstate 93, and that's happening and it's getting completed. So what the point of this is that it will be a tremendous boon to our economy. And I think particularly the lifestyles of families now, when you have two working parents in a family, it's very difficult to find high quality jobs all in the same place. And so imagine how we could expand opportunity and quality of life for people who could live in New Hampshire and one parent could work in Boston and still get home at a reasonable time, or vice versa. There are younger couples who want to live in Boston but could work in terrific jobs here in New Hampshire. And we are lucky that our economy is growing, but this will continue to help grow the economy and really improve quality of life, because sitting in traffic for 2 hours a day is not in anyone's best interest.
Well, maybe they're listening to NHPR. I'm not sure. In that case, it's not so bad.
And on the rail with your earbuds.
With your earbuds. You know, I know you're not a rail expert, Congresswoman, but I did want to ask you this. You know, we have looked at this issue for a long, long time in New Hampshire. The cost always comes up. Also, the idea that New Hampshire's population is too dispersed, it's too rural, there aren't enough people to make it worth the while. We'll build it and they won't come.
Well, that's why we're looking at these different alternatives in this study, because one of the alternatives is extending the MBTA from Lowell to Nashua. And so if you could do this in an incremental way where they're already coming, you don't have to worry about, build it and they'll come starting new. And I think anybody that's sat in traffic, either going to Boston or coming from, will realize there are plenty of people in the region. But that's what the study's about. My opponent voted to abolish the committee. She just literally doesn't believe in it.
You mentioned two parents working, people mm-hmm. trying to get better jobs. And I did want to transition to the idea of income inequality. Democrats are talking a lot
yes.
about this. The Federal Reserve Chairwoman, Janet Yellen, says she's very concerned about the impact on our economy and our society. Here's the question, though. Democrats have had control of the White House and the Senate since 2008, so 6 years. But you look at the numbers, this wage gap is getting worse, not better. Could somebody, Congresswoman, fairly look at your party and say, hey, you guys, this is your number one issue, mm-hmm. income inequality. How come you've made no progress? You've had two out of three for the last 6 years.
And two out of three doesn't get you where you need to be with Speaker Boehner in the Speaker's office, because I don't know if all of your listeners understand, but we can't get bills to the floor if he won't bring them to the floor. And he's been stymied by the Tea Party. And, something as simple as raising the minimum wage, which is something that we're all behind. My opponent abolished the minimum wage and the Tea Party won't let us even take a vote on that. So I think, and the other thing you have to look at is all the Republican governors across the country that have rolled back the minimum wage. Look what Bill O'Brien did when he was in the House here. So I think it's something that's important. We talk about it a lot. I talk a lot about equal pay for equal work, because I think it's tragic that at this day and age, and I've been in the workforce now close to 30 years, we've improved, but we still have women here in New Hampshire that aren't paid fairly for the job that that they're doing. And I think that impacts the whole family. It impacts the economy here in our state, and we need to raise – a rising tide lifts all boats.
Well, speaking of the minimum wage, Democrats have been talking a lot about that, but Republicans, don't want to do it, and they've got their reasons, and maybe we can go through them after mm-hmm. the break. Mm-hmm. But you talked about the farm bill and how hard you worked with compromise and how you had to give something up. But in the end, you got something that, wasn't bad. Could you try harder to find compromise with Republicans on this issue of the wage gap? Maybe you don't get the whole potato, but you get a bite.
I'd take $9 an hour, but I'm telling you, they won't even bring any bill to the
floor. I mean, I'm
not
even talking about minimum wage. I'm talking
right.
about other avenues to close this wage gap.
I don't think they have any interest in it. I don't think they see it as a big issue. And I think you'd have to ask them, but I honestly have not seen that as an area for compromise. We have lots of areas where we can find common ground, most notably cutting the debt and deficit, looking for common ground. And I've certainly, that's been a big priority for me, starting United Solutions. We can talk about it after the break, but it's something that I've been very involved in.
All right. And we will talk more after a short break. More conversation with Congresswoman Ann McLean Custer in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange on NHPR. Welcome back to our campaign series of Rudman Center Conversations with the Candidates at UNH School of Law. Our candidate is New Hampshire's Congresswoman from the 2nd District, Democrat Ann McLean Custer. And Congresswoman Custer, I did want to turn to foreign policy, but also let you wrap up that question I asked about income inequality. And Democrats have been talking about minimum wage. That seems to be an intractable debate. It's not going anywhere. So I was trying to ask you, what are other ideas are there? If that's not going
sure.
anywhere, What else can we look at?
Well, one thing that's been really terrific about visiting all these companies across New Hampshire is seeing the companies that are really thriving are the ones that value the workforce. And just a shout out to a few like Hypertherm, who have what we call employee stock options, where the employees are actually owning the company. And there are lots of different options like that that are very creative, where companies treat the workforce well, pay them fair and equal wages. We were over at Badger Bomb, where they have literally a kitchen and serve soup and a daycare. And it's a great company that's doing very, very well. Let me contrast that with a company like Fairpoint right now, where their workers have gone out on strike. They're not willing to come to the table on fair wages. They're not willing to value the workers. And it's a company that came from, as we say in New Hampshire, away. And I don't think they really understand our New Hampshire values, which is that you will get the best performance and your company will be successful if you value employees. And so I don't think this has to be a partisan issue. It has been this particular cycle. But I think regardless of political party, I think people need to value their employees, value their capital, their most important asset. And that's why I've spent a lot of time on education, workforce training, and working with our community colleges to make sure that our workers are trained for 21st century jobs right here in New Hampshire.
Let's turn to foreign policy, because sure, that's been grabbing headlines all fall. A question on Syria. You joined a majority in the House voting in favor of President Obama's plan to arm supposedly moderate Syrian rebels. But some of the other people in this campaign, Republicans and Democrats, actually, that I've talked to, say, we're not really sure who we're dealing with there. The friend today could be an enemy tomorrow. What do you think, Congresswoman Custer? Why did you vote in favor of this plan?
Well, I voted for the airstrikes in the region to give Secretary of State Kerry the time to bring our allies on board. The vote was a very limited one for 90 days. And the goal is that we need to bring the allies, both Arab allies in the region, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, etc., as well as Western allies to this fight. Look, ISIS is a horrific terrorist organization. I've been to the Jim Foley funeral. I know that this is a threat like none other. And it's very different than our traditional sort of armies against armies. That's not what we're dealing with here. But I feel very, very strongly that the United States should not go it along. This is a big difference in my campaign with my opponent. I am opposed to us coming in as the world policemen, boots on the ground, battalions and tens of thousands of troops. We can't afford it in blood or treasure.
So opposed to boots on the ground, supporting the airstrikes, as most people have in this campaign. What about arming so-called Syrian moderates, Congresswoman Custer?
What it's about, it's a training program outside of the region, by the way. This would be in Saudi Arabia. And I share the skepticism about who these parties are. We insisted upon some controls and very close congressional oversight. But I think we do need to help ramp up the capacity for allies in the region.
Well, and I'm sure you've heard people say this, that arming some groups who may or may not turn out to be friends of ours could inadvertently be helping Syrian President Assad. If we're helping groups fight ISIS, we could actually be helping Assad out, who is widely thought of as a very bad actor in the Middle East. I wonder what you think about that. I mean, it's just—
I certainly agree.
Somebody described it as a game of whack-a-mole. You know, you hit one and something else pops up.
It is a very complex region. I was reading today about the Kurds, and it's a fascinating story about a group of women in the Kurdish military that are coming to help us fight ISIS, which is sort of an intriguing concept when you think of what ISIS thinks of the role of women in the world. But yes, I have tremendous concerns. You know, think about it. One of the reasons that ISIS is so strong is because of all the weaponry that we left behind in Iraq. I felt the first war in Iraq was a mistake. I don't want us to get dragged into another war. But we didn't bring home the munitions, the tanks, tanks, the airplanes, all of that. And they've gotten their hands on it.
ISIS
and they get
has.
$1 million a day in oil revenues. And that's one of the reasons they're so strong.
Although I remember reading that it would have cost so much to bring all that equipment home that they just decided
exactly.
to leave
that's
it.
That's the catch 22. But I think what you're seeing is sort of a cascade effect of bad decisions that go all the way back to the Bush administration on why we went in there in the first place.
Are you worried that we are inadvertently helping out then? Assad. President
I think it's
Assad.
Very complex. And that's why I say this legislation was very short term and it had precautions in it for Congress to very, very closely monitor. And I have every expectation that there will be a lengthy debate when we return in November about what is the next step. I am going to be looking for allies in the region and allies abroad to come to the fore. You know, there are 200 Brits or more fighting with ISIS. I think they need to be a part of the solution and need to be standing shoulder to shoulder. We shouldn't be carrying this alone.
British nationals who've been radicalized? Is that
That's
what you're
my
saying?
Understanding.
Yeah.
And so I'm saying the British military should be part of the solution.
Well, and I did want to ask you very quickly about Iraq. You mentioned all the equipment that was left there when the U.S. pulled out. And certainly there's a fear that Iraq may be overrun by ISIS. Is it possible, Congresswoman Custer, that the U.S. in 2008, tired of war, encouraged by an anti-war presidential candidate, Barack Obama, pulled out too quickly and let Iraq plunge back into chaos?
Well, here's what I know. We are tired of war as a people, and there's good reason. This gives me a bit of an opening to talk about my work with the Veterans Affairs Committee, which is a tremendous honor. But I was at a deployment ceremony today. This may come to most New Hampshire people as a surprise. It was 10 people that were headed back into the theater, back into Kuwait and Iraq. And they'll be flying a mission of carrying people back and forth. They won't be frontline in combat, but obviously they'll be in danger. And my feeling is this is why I'm opposed to us getting dragged back into this war. We need to take care of our troops and take care of our veterans, and we need to focus on that. I'm anti-war, pro-veteran. We need to take the steps that we have taken this summer to reform the VA.
Can we
and
talk
make sure
about that? Yeah.
Sure, I'd love to.
Because I have a question here from someone in our audience, and again, thank you to this person. What obstacles and possibilities do you identify for helping veterans returning from Afghanistan? So let's talk about that, Congresswoman. As you know, there was a scandal at the Veterans Administration earlier this year. Veterans waiting very long stretches before getting that first appointment, some even dying before they could get it. Did the committee that you sit on, the Veterans Affairs Committee, did you fall down on the job here?
Well, actually, we discovered the situation in Phoenix. That was a colleague of mine that held a hearing out in Arizona, discovered the situation in Phoenix, and our committee jumped right on it. Honestly, we had a dozen hearings. I was present at every one, despite comments made last night. In fact, they were late at night. Some went till 12:30 in the morning. And again, looking for bipartisan solution, we worked together. One of the things that I'm most proud of is we used as a model a pilot project that started right here in New Hampshire. We have an issue in New Hampshire where some veterans have to travel too far to get care. So we've done a number of things. One is to open up new clinics in Berlin and Colebrook, which I'm very excited about.
It just happened a week or two ago in the North Country.
Yep. And that is one of the big deliverables, if you will, from my first 2 years in office. The second piece of this is that we entered into a contract, the VA, with Concord Hospital. We're one of the only states in the country without a full-service veterans hospital. And so we, through discussions with Secretary Shinseki and the VA here, we entered into a contract for private care that would be reimbursed. And
this so you take a voucher, basically.
A relatively novel solution. What I'm very pleased to report is that that became the model for the Veterans Reform Bill that passed in July in the House and the Senate and was signed into law. So we took, which was a terrible situation in Phoenix, and created a solution that's going to help veterans all across the country.
You know, just looking at this as a complete outside voter, you hear about men and women coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan with traumatic brain injury and losing limbs. And we've talked to these people on our program. It just makes you wonder, how did it get to such a low point before that hearing in Arizona where mm-hmm. people discovered, wow, how did it even get so bad?
Well, it wasn't. We knew that there were challenges. And one of the things during the Secretary Shinseki regime, a series of decisions were made. So you had the vets coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, which added tremendous pressure. You had decisions made about Vietnam veterans, and particularly a presumption about Agent Orange. So that, do you remember that whole issue historically where they had to prove that these symptoms were related to them?
That was very upsetting
now,
for them.
If you were in theater during that period of time, it's a presumption. We also had a presumption, a new presumption on an issue that I've been working on, which is sexual assault in the military. Again, a bipartisan bill working with a Republican from Indiana. We passed a whistleblower protection for people coming forward to identify sexual assault in the military, something I'm very proud of working on. And we have a new presumption about military sexual assault. If you have a person that had a very, very successful career and suddenly a dramatic drop off, rather than going back and saying, but you didn't tell anybody about this at the time, well, there's good reason. It might have been the commanding officer that was the assailant. And so all of this led to a dramatic increase in volume in the VA. All of a sudden. And that led to, in other parts of the country, these long wait lists. I'm very pleased to report in New Hampshire, aside from a couple of conditions, cataracts, eyes, for some reason, is a big one. But we tend not to have the delays, but we have the challenge of people getting the care in a geographically convenient way. I want to give a shout-out to, again, a New Hampshire public-private partnership. It's called Veterans Count Easter Seals. And this is our National Guard working with a private organization here in New Hampshire with federal funding. So it's a complex group coming together, but to provide support for veterans and their families in the pre-deployment, during the deployment, and post-deployment cycle when they're coming home and have the challenges that you've discussed.
Two more things I want to ask you, Congresswoman. You mentioned your attendance at these hearings that went very late into the night. A Union Leader article found that you had a very good attendance record for your work in the full House, the Agriculture Committee, and the Veterans Committee, but your attendance at the Small Business Committee was less than stellar. The article said you missed 70% of the meetings there. How do you account for that? Was it a mistake to sit on three major committees? Did you overextend yourself?
Well, it's unusual to accept three major committees, and I'm part of the leadership from the freshman class. I don't think it's a mistake because there are issues affecting small business here in New Hampshire, and I'm particularly proud to have brought not one but two New Hampshire people down to testify before the Small Business Committee. I will tell you it's one of the more partisan and less functional committees. And
the Small Business Committee.
Yes, and so a number of – you have to make – and I think you've heard about this from the other members. You have to make decisions about your schedule where your sort of highest and best use. My primary focus was Veterans Affairs, agriculture. The Small Business Committee, when it impacted small businesses here in New Hampshire, I was absolutely there and present and proud to be a part of it. And when it was a partisan agenda bashing, the administration, I tended not to participate.
If you are sent back to Congress by the voters of the 2nd District, would you continue to serve on three committees, or is that too much?
It might be a consideration. I mean, I'll wait till after Tuesday for the voters to speak, but I certainly hope to be returning and will have a consideration about where my time is best used. But, you know, again, it gave me the opportunity to have a very close relationship with the Small Business Administration to bring the Export-Import Bank up to New Hampshire to grow opportunities for New Hampshire businesses to grow their markets. So I think sometimes we maybe get a little hung up on particular stats and not look at the big picture. I want to be serving the business community and grow our economy.
Well, last question for you, Congressman Custer, if I could. On Monday night, we asked State Representative Marilinda Garcia what she liked about you. And I'm paraphrasing here, but she basically said she admires any woman who gets out there, makes a name for herself, especially in such an important public policy job like Congress. What about you? This has been a tough campaign, but let's end on a positive note. What do you find admirable about your opponent?
Sure. No, I would definitely say the same for her. And I think about myself at that age frequently when I'm with her. And I think I'm very impressed at her diving into this. It's challenging. It's hard to do. She's been well prepared. I think she has a very close family, as I do, and it was fun to see them last night. We actually ended up at a restaurant at a table right next to her and to know, see her family. And and I think
that must have been a little
and
awkward.
She's an amazing No, I mean, look, this is New Hampshire. You know, we do this, and so there's no ill will. I'm impressed by her, and I'm particularly impressed by her ability on the harp. I have to say, I love harp music, and I've heard from a number of people around the district. She's very, very talented.
All right. Well, Congresswoman, that is all the time we have, and I want to thank you and especially our large audience here tonight for coming out. I want to let everybody know that you can go to nhpr.org for more information, including a complete list of past forums. You can listen to all 8 candidates sit down with us here at the Rudman Center. So if you missed any of them, go to nhpr.org and listen to some of our past forums. While you're there, check out NHPR's ongoing coverage of Election 2014. Again, thanks to everybody for coming out tonight. Especially I'd like to thank the team at NHPR and UNH Law that helped put these forums together. It's been a super effort. And to you again, Congresswoman Custer, for being with us.
Thank you, Laura, and to your whole crew. It's been wonderful.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.